Next, we have Mutual Enclaw versus Day.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Brent Beecher.
Would you like to reserve some time?
I would, please. 2 minutes. And I represent the Mutual of Enumclaw. In every insurance case that has applied the remedy of coverage by estoppel, in every jurisdiction, every single one, that remedy has been applied in order to discharge the liability of an insured. Ms. Day asks this court to turn that remedy on its head. Here, Smith and Lee's claims against her were discharged forever in 2011, and she is asking this court to use the remedy of estoppel to make her a very rich woman. This isn't Mutual of Enumclaw ignoring the case law. This is Mutual of Enumclaw requesting that the court properly apply it and to see past the contortions that are required to arrive at Ms. Day's conclusions. I'd like to address 3 points today regarding the nature of the estoppel component of the judgment. The first is that the claimed wound here is self-inflicted. Where a lawyer fights holding feet to fire to have a $10 million judgment replace a dismissal with prejudice for his client, there is something distorted. The second is that the wound is imaginary. Where an insured agrees that she has caused $10 million worth of damage to a third party and the supposed remedy against the insurer is to put that $10 million in her pocket with no obligation to pay that debt, there is something perverse. And the third is that this imaginary self-inflicted wound was not proximately caused by Mutual of Enumclaw.
When we look at ANVIA,
yes,
and you rely on it to a healthy degree, isn't it a fair statement that ANVIA's key observation is there's no reservation of rights in ANVIA? That's why it's akin to Coventry in the first party situation.
Yes, Your Honor, that is why. It's important to follow the reason for that conclusion in ANVIA. In ANVIA, the reason that that mattered was because that nothing about the insurer's bad faith could have implicated the result of the judgment. And the same is true here. This is not the kind of garden variety scenario where there is something about the nature of the insurer's defense that is related to the coverage question, where the insurer can put its thumb on the scale of the liability case against the insured in order to achieve a good coverage result. In this case, those two things were entirely separate and distinct. The only coverage question was about what had transpired between Ms. Day and her agent 6 years before any of this even happened. So in this case, it is very important to recognize that there is no complaint about the nature of the defense that was provided. There is no allegation that anything about the coverage issue had any bleed over, so to speak, into the defense of the insured. So this raises an issue. If it's not, if the court isn't willing to go along with my admitted extension of the ANVIA logic, then Mutual of Enumclaw should have at least been provided the opportunity to challenge the causation element, which it never was. And this ANVIA says there's no causation as a matter of law. That's essentially the ANVIA holding, because they say where there is no obligation to defend, where there is no obligation to indemnify, what the insurer did doesn't affect the outcome against the insured.
Where does that transfer, crossover, maybe I'm missing the point, where does the crossover to the presumption of harm has been rebutted? Where does that fit in your, because that seems to me to be a central question here. I'm not sure how that relates to this other more academic analysis of when the coverage by estoppel kicks in.
I'm sorry, I want to understand the question exactly. Is your question about how the presumption, should it have arisen, rebutted in this case?
No, it seems to me you have the argument in your briefing and today too that, you know, under these circumstances where the judgments that were entered were subject to this full satisfaction of judgment under the 2011 settlement agreement, there's no harm. There's no, what do you call it, rebuttal of harm or So you don't have a presumption of harm, therefore you don't have coverage by estoppel, seems to me to be one of your core arguments. But I'm not sure if I'm tracking. This seems to be a separate track, that coverage by estoppel doesn't kick in apart from that concern about a rebutted presumption of harm.
Exactly right, Your Honor. I mean, there are shades of the issues that overlap into both areas of the argument, but that is exactly right. Those are two distinct issues. So these issues are confused and bled together in the case law as well.
Mm-hmm.
What you're talking about, what is the presumption? Is it a presumption that there was, does that just eliminate the causation argument, or does that lead you directly to whatever it was out there, regardless of its effectiveness against the insured? And those are two distinct issues.
Failure to investigate, recognized in Tank as bad faith, is also a procedural misstep as addressed in Onvia?
A failure to investigate is a very broad subject. In this case, we're talking about a reformation claim, and no case in Washington has ever discussed the issue of the insurer's obligation to investigate a reformation claim. And this is a very different kind of thing than what is usually addressed in the duty to investigate context, because it is a separate cause of action that belongs to the insured. It is saying that the policy that we're talking about is not what it appears to be. The burden is on the insured to prove by clear, cogent, and convincing evidence that both the parties at the time intended the policy to be something other than it actually was. So this cause of action was, in fact, asserted by Ms. Day before she says she was found out about the issue in her answer. Yes, Tank literally says for sure that there is a duty to investigate, and that in the context of Tank, certainly what was being discussed was the insurance company has an obligation to investigate the coverage under the policy and the claims against the insured. Because this was a very different kind of assertion, where it's in an entirely different universe in terms of the way that it is resolved. This isn't a preponderance of the evidence. It isn't something that the insurance company would typically have to investigate. And just from a policy matter, if the insurance company was required to give the benefit of the doubt every single time there was someone said, I think my agent told me that there was coverage for this claim, what wouldn't be covered? Because if the insurance company is required to get a judicial resolution of a reformation claim before they deny a duty to defend, that pushes our case law just in an entirely new direction.
Before your time runs out, I want to give you a chance to answer the question on the treble damages
or yes.
Emotional distress. Why wasn't that waived? That specific objection wasn't raised in the trial court. Why do we reach that issue?
Because for one thing, there was no authority at that point. All of the authority that has come out regarding that issue has been subsequent to the date that the issue was presented to the trial court. So it wasn't an issue that anyone could have found if they were looking at established case law. Second, it is a discretionary matter with the court, and I see my time is such that I will rely on my briefing for the rest of that point. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Catherine Smith representing the respondent, Myung Day. I want to make very clear to start out with that this is a bad faith case. It's the insured's bad faith case, and that's been the case in this state since at least 1986. And the real issue here is whether an insurer can insulate itself from liability for bad faith by defending under a reservation of rights without investigating the insured's claim for coverage and without informing the insured of the true coverage issue. Now, the trial court in this case and the jury made a determination that, in fact, Mutual of Inclaw had acted in bad faith by undertaking that, and it had lots of evidence to support that, including the factual evidence of the claims director for Mutual of Inclaw itself, which said, we should have investigated this, we should have told Ms. Day that our agent had the authority to automatically bind us, and under these circumstances, this should have been resolved before we defended under a reservation of rights that didn't tell her what the coverage issue was. caused a deck action, started a deck action against her while this defense was going on, and then put her in the position of undertaking all of the investigation to find out what, in fact, the true coverage issue was.
How was Day harmed by the entry of the judgments against Day in favor of Lee and...
Well, this argument that the insured is not harmed by entry of judgments or by a settlement agreement that that preserves that bad faith right has been made in every single bad faith case since our courts have established the way that we're going to address bad faith in this case. The issue, the argument always is, you didn't have to pay the judgment, you wouldn't have paid the judgment, you didn't have the money to pay the judgment, and therefore you're not harmed. And the real issue here is, and the court most clearly established this in Wu, but this has been the premise for our bad faith law since 1986 and certainly since 2002 in Basil and Tank and Truck, and that is that this is the insured's right of action. It is not the plaintiff's right of action. And the way that we are going to establish damages, because we cannot rerun the course, is by providing coverage for estoppel, by estoppel for a reasonable settlement amount.
Isn't the dilemma, though, that in this situation, these facts, unique as far as I can tell, at the time, the day the judgment's entered, Day has the absolute right under the September 2011 settlement agreement for a full satisfaction of that judgment.
And why does she? Because the insurer in this case and the insurer's portfolio lawyer agree to this dismissal without telling Ms. Day's bad faith, and by saying, we agree to this amount. We agree that it's reasonable. We agree you don't have to get a judgment. And then they come in 2 years later and say, oh, gotcha. No judgment was entered in this case.
Well, but the original settlement provided for the judgment.
It did. And, in fact, when they said that this was an issue, we went back in and got a judgment. And I can't say any better than when the reasonableness determination was made on this judgment that was entered, Mutual and Klopp made this argument, oh, you know, we got you, you didn't get a judgment entered in this case. And the trial court rejected that because they said you weren't harmed in any way. If you look at the bad faith cases.
Well, she wasn't harmed in the amount of the $7 million judgment.
Well, but that's true in any bad faith case. The insured never has to pay the judgment.
So if they hadn't done that and had the satisfaction in her hand, she'd have been better off by having an actual judgment against her?
It's not a question of whether she would have been better off. It's a question of the court, the Supreme Court, has established coverage by estoppel under these circumstances to deter the insurer from this type of conduct. Because otherwise what you end up with is a situation like this where the insurer comes in and says, look, you know, you weren't harmed because you didn't have to pay this judgment. And they have made this argument in every single bad faith
case. But my point is, if the alternative action for them was to say, you're not restricted to collecting from the agent, you're entitled to collect from the agent and from the bad faith claim.
I'm sorry, when you say you mean the plaintiff?
Day.
Well,
the plaintiff would have been entitled to, right. So they enter a judgment against her, and she can assign that to the plaintiff, but she's sitting there with the judgment.
Respectfully, Your Honor, that suggests that the bad faith claim only arises if it's assigned to the plaintiff. And one part of Tank that people don't talk about very often is the fact that we didn't go down that road in 1986. Tank expressly rejects the idea that the insurer's obligation is to the injured party. The obligation is to the insured. And it doesn't make a difference that portion of this claim was not assigned in this case. It is the insured's right. And all of the analysis and all of the cases since then have rejected the idea that because the defendant, the insured, is not placed at risk for the judgment or is not placed at risk for any of the other activity, that somehow there's no damage, that there's no harm, no foul. And the reason that that is done is because we don't know what would have happened. We don't know what would have happened in this case had Mutual of Enumclaw done what they were supposed to, which was to investigate this before they undertook a reservation of rights or to investigate it and say that they were going to have coverage, which their own claims director said was because the tie goes to the insured. But what you're being asked to do here is to go back to 1985 and require an insured under these circumstances to reform the contract.
I think the question that Judge Perellin was getting at is, what's the harm? Even if there was a harm to her, the harm, the way this was structured, was not the $7 million judgment harm.
Your Honor, that's all I can tell you is that is the case in every single bad faith claim. The insured is never responsible for the judgment.
If a discharge in bankruptcy insulates the insured to the point there is no harm, as in Werlinger, why isn't the right in this case to have a full satisfaction of the judgment the equivalent?
Well, first of all, there was no right once the judgment was reentered, once the motion to vacate was granted and a judgment was entered. Second, in
the claims against HUD had been completely resolved at that point a year earlier.
Only because the insurer had said that it didn't make a difference if we entered a judgment or not. They had agreed, they had stipulated settlement. It was like in Miller, where the same argument was being made, that, in fact, well, you didn't get a judgment. You didn't get a litigated judgment. That's the other thing that's being argued here, is that you somehow had to continue to litigate. It's quite clear under our Supreme Court's law that you do not have to do that, and particularly in a case such as this.
But the point was, the settlement also provided for both entry of judgment and satisfaction of judgment. Doesn't the right to file the satisfaction then allow you to vacate the or satisfy the judgment regardless of when it's entered?
No, Your Honor, because that's true in every bad faith case. I mean, that is just not accurate.
But it's factually accurate here. They had a satisfaction in hand, even on the delayed entry judgment, that it could have been.
Your Honor, I don't believe that there was a satisfaction provided. There was a dismissal of the claim, but there was no satisfaction.
But the settlement provided that one could be entered, didn't it?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, but I'll check and see.
I mean, I
don't think it makes any difference, because that would be the case in any situation where you have a covenant judgment can only be satisfied from the bad faith claim. The real distinction here, and it's not one that makes a difference for the nature of the claim, is that the plaintiff, through litigation fatigue, frankly, had taken an assignment of only the claim against the broker. But it's very clear that the claim is not the plaintiff's. That was true under Tank. It's been true ever since then. And what you're being asked to do here is to say this type of action only redounds to the benefit of a plaintiff, which is not true. It's not true under Tank, and that the Supreme Court didn't mean it when they said in all of the covenant judgment cases, continuing through Wu and in this court in Marotti, that the settlement establishes the amount of damages.
Even if the covenant judgment isn't assigning the bad faith claim?
Yes, because the plaintiff can have, when I say plaintiff, I mean the injured party, can never have more rights than the insured, because they are prosecuting the insured's claim. And this is the insured's claim, not the plaintiff's. And that's been very clear since Tank. What you're being asked to do here today is to go back to 1985 and create a cause of action on behalf of the plaintiffs. And I'll guarantee you, the next time we're sitting here, if you do that, we're going to be told that the plaintiff doesn't have a right of action because they don't have a right of action under Tank. We ask you to affirm this judgment because it fits within all of the bad faith law that's been established over the last 30 years. Thank you.
Thank you.
All of these estoppel cases that they're talking about are about unpaid debts. We're not talking about going back to 1985 and creating a cause of action for the injured party. That's an unpleasant fact in this case, that the injured party would get a fraction of what the insured would get out of this if the court affirmed a covenant judgment estoppel. But it is not, the assignment itself has nothing to do with this case. If Ms. Day had kept the bad faith cause of action against Mutual of Edenclaw, as she did, and a judgment had been entered that was boundless, that could be executed against the insurance company or executed at all, this would be a different case. We have, in this situation, there was, in fact, very clearly a agreement to provide Day a satisfaction of judgment.
But no actual satisfaction ever entered or signed?
There wasn't. It was contractually agreed to be signed.
Right.
And so in the same sense that Day was entitled, and I put that in scare quotes, because to enter a judgment against herself by that agreement, she had the same degree of entitlement to enter satisfaction of that judgment.
But you're asking us to find she necessarily had to, or that she's stopped from claiming the presumed damages because she didn't, aren't you?
Because she didn't enter it?
Yes.
I think that the satisfaction itself is kind of an icing on the cake of the argument, because regardless of the satisfaction, there is no further debt to Smith and Lee. That is clear from the settlement agreement. That is clear from the dismissal with prejudice. The settlement agreement says once the assigned claim against the agent, once that has been resolved, and it doesn't matter how, if it's been resolved by a final judgment against the agent, if it's been resolved by a settlement with the agent, no matter what, no matter how it is assigned, the claims against the Day are over forever. And that is not true of all of these other covenant judgment claims. Thank you.
Thank you.